So I brought along one of the oscillators, if anyone is really interested, can fondle it. Don't be too careful, this one is broken. Well, last summer it occurred to me that someone should reproduce Moses' results, see if they could be transported 150 miles from Penn State to Ithaca, New York. But since then, they've been transported much further to Japan. And well, in the next talk, you'll hear about the confirmation of the supersolid phenomena from our colleague over here. But anyway, we started. One motivation was to reproduce Moses' results, at least in bulk helium. I really had no doubt that we would, or that someone would. Second motivation was to look at this problem in a different geometry, and I'll discuss that in a moment. But before I go any further, I want to mention the names of the people involved in this experiment, who are just two. Myself and Sophie Rittner, a new graduate student from Germany, who's been very enthusiastic and helpful in the experiment. Well, as I mentioned, we've looked at two cells. One is cylindrical, conventional geometry, and the second has a square interior, thanks to Greg Dash. It occurred to me that if there's a question of slipping at the boundary, that if you put the crystal into a square container, there's no question anymore. It's mechanically constrained by the walls during the rotation. But, however, if you have a superfluid in a square container, it's not completely constrained by the motion of the walls. And, in fact, this is a solution of Laplace's equation for this problem with a square rotating boundary, and if it's rotating in that direction, this wall is sort of advancing, and the fluid has to get out of the way, so it flows on these paths. This wall is retreating, and you have to backfill with fluid. So that's the situation. Looks sort of complicated in the lab frame. One important thing is that the fluid in the corners essentially is carried with the container. There's a very nice result in fluid mechanics that for potential flow, as long as the angle of the walls is less than 180 degrees, you have zero velocity for potential flow. If, however, you go past 180 degrees, it immediately becomes infinite at the corner. That's just Laplace's equation. But if you look at the situation in while sitting on the rotating container, then it's actually much simpler. What you see then is this fluid in the center just stands still, and in your framework is rotating backwards. And as you go out toward the boundaries, then there has to be some modification because it's a square box, and you get this rather simple pattern. If you ask what fraction of the mass of the fluid is coupled to the rotation or oscillation, Sandy Fetter worked this out and published in 1974, that it's 15.6%. And it depends on he did a much more general problem, a rectangle with various aspect ratios. And obviously, if you make the rectangle very much longer than it is wide, then you get a much smaller, much bigger coupling, which is similar to what Moses was talking about this morning.
So for square, the amount of depth helium is 15%?
15.6. Or more if you want to evaluate more terms in the series. Anyway, but the point really from our point of view was that we could constrain the crystal. So if slipping at the boundary is the explanation of what Moses sees, then we have an experiment which will differentiate between that kind of model and other models, such as, say, a superfluid flow within the interior. Well, because of this geometric effect, when you here's the oscillator, the purity of the oscillator, and at this point we start to introduce helium, liquid helium, and could be superfluid. It really, in these problems, it doesn't much matter whether it's superfluid or not, because you're oscillating some frequency. There's a viscous penetration depth set by the normal fluid and its density, or the total fluid and its viscosity. And that is quite small at these frequencies. You know, we're talking about microns. So not very much of the fluid is entrained by the motion in any case. If you put molasses into a cylindrical oscillator, you'll see big moment of inertia change because it's very viscous. It'll go with the oscillator. If you put helium in or water, it's much less. So this effect basically is the period shift which comes about from this geometric constraint of the square container. Well, what we really wanted to do was examine the supersolid. So we did the conventional thing based on early experience with the oscillator, which I passed around, which in fact failed at higher pressures. I wanted to be conservative, so Sophie and I went with the lowest pressure we thought was reasonable. And we could be fairly careful about that because we have on the oscillator cell itself a strain gauge which is sensitive to small fractions of a bar. So we can tell whether we're a hundredth of a bar away from the melting curve from our calibration of the strain gauge. So we went with the pressure which would bring us out and enter the solid phase just below the bottom edge of the BCC phase. So we would go in. As we cool down, we would traverse the BCC part of the phase diagram to a little below, and then we would go into the solid phase. We, according to our measurements at least, this crystal melts at 25.8 bar. So we're safe as in terms of having fluid in the system. Another way you can tell whether you have fluid is that when you're in the two-phase system, the Q of the oscillator is terrible. There's a lot of dissipation. And also there's a signature in the period, too. You don't get the full period shift. Well, here's data much noisier than what you've seen. This plot was plotted a little too hastily. It has data. This data set here you completely ignore. It's actually taken at another time, and it happened to be in the same file, so it got plotted. But represents a ring down from a higher amplitude. As we reduce the drive level and the amplitude goes down, so this is the amplitude goes up and the parent Q. This is dissipation, not amplitude. I should be clear. Most of everything I'm going to talk about basically plots dissipation rather than amplitude, which is the inverse. Nice thing about dissipation is that they add, whereas amplitudes don't. So you can separate out the dissipation due to the empty cell from the dissipation due to the helium within it. Now, for this apparatus, the empty cell Q is about a million, a little bit below, and that gives you a dissipation on this scale a little bit above one, about like here. So we're dissipation of the empty cell is less than the cell with helium in it. Okay, so this measurement, which is fairly recent, serves to confirm the effect. Here it is. Here is the traditional dissipation peak associated with the transition. We didn't just stop with this one measurement, of course. The reason for all the scatter in the period is the fact we were taking these measurements with 10-second counting times on the period measurement. And if you go to 100 seconds, this scatter goes down by a factor of 10 because it's basically random, determined by the fluctuations of the last oscillation that you're counting.
The dissipation doesn't suffer this problem.
So it's not a okay. Well, following this measurement, we actually thought we would do some annealing, and we raised the temperature of the cell to about a little above 1 degree, but probably below 1.5 degrees. and then it was allowed to cool overnight, rather slowly. And what we found then was something different. This looks like the same, but the period scale is quite different. This, forget about that stuff, but if you believe there's a level signal here, here's the transition, and then this total change is only about 6 nanoseconds rather than 28 or 30.
You're going to convert to us to rho s, or about what rho s?
Well, we could convert it to rho s. Again, this before we had, you know, 0.6%.
That was the previous one.
Yes, and this then would be down by a factor of 6 or something from that.
Right.
And much more obvious than the changes up here, which is the dissipation signal. Now, one thing that's happened actually is the total dissipation is lower here than it was in the previous measurements. So, following this this measurement,
So now, before this dissipation peak was so close to where the rho s was saturating. Now it's actually where
that's between. It's more or less the peak is more or less with the maximum slope.
Uh-huh.
It was
like the derivative,
wasn't
it?
Yeah.
And what about now?
Which this slope is very ill-defined because of the noise, and this is still
okay,
10 seconds.
So that rise there is just some noise.
Yeah, it's just, I don't think this means anything.
And what about those 2 points under the curve? Did I
pay
any attention at all?
Maybe? Well, let me go.
Lower.
Things will become clearer. This. Following this measurement, you'll notice that the dissipation is about 4 on this scale. And so we then warmed up to higher temperatures. And I don't have a nice PowerPoint plot, but I do have a handmade transparency, which I copied from something I plotted myself. This is the dissipation data at as we go up towards warming, towards higher temperatures. We're starting down here. This is the last point of the previous graph, about a little above 4. Then there's a missing data section. Then we come to the actual measurements. And lo and behold, as you warm up, the dissipation increases. And there's a big, sizable peak in the dissipation. Now, we believe probably what's going on is the crystal is annealing, and the remnant whatever they are just leaving. And while they're leaving, well, this is a continuously swept measurement, so we're not sitting at one point just and seeing this thing. I suspect if you sat here, you would see this go away. Something to be done.
Can you go back in temperature down?
We could do that. We have not done that. We do go back in temperature. So we just were interested in warming all the way up and melting the crystal, but we were watching the dissipation as we did that. As we warm up, this is the level that we had when we associated with the superfluid, rather weak superfluid transition we saw before this. We warm up, and there's this region of increased dissipation, and then, which is actually much more striking when you're taking the data, because what you see is the amplitude starts growing like mad. It goes way above the level it was at lower temperatures. And the dissipation drops down almost to the level of the empty oscillator. And we're still in the solid phase. The solid does not melt until this point.
What happens to the period shift during this process?
What?
I've
got that data. It's not. I did not bring a bugraph of that, but you can. Nothing. Well, the thing's going on. You can definitely see things going on. And particularly, it gives a very sharp mark of the point where the crystal really starts to melt.
So, what is the time frame?
This is a couple hours.
So you just continue to follow without stopping.
No. Because, so at this point, we start to melt, and then the dissipation goes up, and it goes actually through the roof of this building on this scale. That's when you're really in the two-phase region. You've got some kind of slush probably in the cell. So we went up to the point where we completely melted, and at that point, you then see the dissipation characteristic of the liquid filling the cell. We also, of course, have a pressure gauge on here, and which we were not monitoring at this time, but when we have monitored it, you can see the crystal pressure rising as the crystal melts, as you go up the melting curve, and then it goes, it ceases to change and you go in, as you go into the liquid phase. So both in the with the torsional oscillator and its period and the pressure gauge, you can really tell when you're first starting it, when you first hit the melting curve, and also when you leave it. Yes?
I just wanted to clarify to see what I understand. So if I put MOSES data together with your data, so MOSES is saying that if I start from low temperature and before I hit this peak, the weight, before I hit this peak, there is a increase in the energy transition, that it would have an increase in this T-1, but then you say if I go further down, you would have another peak like this, and this peak also would have a change of period.
There is a very large change of the period starts at this point, because you're then into the two-phase region, and the coupling is you get more and more liquid, there's more and more sloshing around. Yes?
John, I never remember the phase diagram well enough, unfortunately, but is there an HCP to BCC transition somewhere in this region?
The lambda line comes in like that. This is about 1.8, and this is about 1.45, I believe. So for this, these measurements, we come in up here someplace, we go down along the, and then go into the pure solid down here someplace. And we see features with our pressure gauge, which we, with imagination, you could believe are cooling to the point, or freezing to the point where you begin to find a BCC phase and then leaving it again down here before you get...
But isn't that peak then right in the BCC line like you said?
Oh, it probably is. No, this one. No. Because we're not going up the melting. This is all taking place coming back along this line.
No, that's
don't believe those temperatures with respect to this. Because we're heating the system and the cell is lagging behind.
So what temperature? So you divide by two or something?
Yeah, well, not by two, but it gets bigger.
John, you said that the whole set of data is about a couple hours, right? So per point, it's like a couple of minutes.
Yeah, these are we're taking measurements about, a couple of minutes, something like that. We're, of course, in this region, in terms of temperature, we're going much more slowly. You can see the points are a lot more dense.
Have you tried to do it at different warming rate? You have not?
Oh, yeah, we've got more than one, but haven't had time, if you notice the date, to do much systematic study of this. But the important thing, I think, is we got down to here, and then we melted the crystal, and then we cooled down again. And on the cooling, the stage temperature went from the melting temperatures down to temperatures at 1 degree or slightly below in about 50 minutes.
That's the quickest. From 1,000 to down to low temperature.
Well, from 2.5 to 1 in about 50 minutes.
And you melted it?
Which is about as fast as we can go. Yeah, we melted it pretty much completely, I think. Okay. The next... So then we, of course, cooled back down. The next following day, we cooled to... This is done in the morning. It wasn't the following day. This was done the morning of the 25th, and on the afternoon of the 25th, we went back down to low temperatures. We had recovered the full supersolid signal, and the dissipation before the above the transition, it had doubled from what it was above the transition of that partially annealed sample we had before. So what we say is annealing can have a strong effect on what you see in terms of the supersolid signal.
It made it. Which way did it go?
Hmm?
Which way did it go? Did it make it stronger? Or
annealing reduces it.
Okay.
So
only by a factor of 6, is it right?
The period shift here is about 30 nanoseconds. And this is 100 second counting data, so it has.
Your slow cooling, you call annealing, takes how long?
Which?
Your slow cooling, which you call annealing, takes how long? How long?
Oh, overnight.
Overnight. So it's about.
I was not there taking, writing down the numbers, so I'm not sure what the temperature profile is.
Sophie hopefully
is plotting that up.
Hope it's 10 hours.
Yeah, say 10 hours.
Fast is about 1 hour.
Yeah. Roughly speaking, yeah. And this, okay, so we cool down, we recover the signal. One thing you might notice is that the dissipation peak associated with this new signal is not as big as the first one. Here is a kind of comparison of the data taken at different times. The curve I've just shown you is the blue curve up at the top. And then here is the curve, the first one we showed you. And between these two, there was a, what I would call now, a partial annealing process. Here are the, and this is the data from the one I showed you, a blown up version of which we think is about 6 nanoseconds remaining as opposed to 30. And so we did the annealing again. And this time, we stayed near the melting curve for a much longer period of time. And when we cooled that down again, this is what we saw in the period. Nothing. There's even a more, if you look at the dissipation in these curves, it's a much stronger indication.
Did I understand that there's no fixed relationship between the amplitude of the period shift and the amplitude of the dissipation? So it's not Cromer's.
Not one-to-one. I mean, we see, well, we've got one example here. But what we're seeing is the dissipation is smaller in our second sample than it was in the first.
Even though
if anything, the period. But to concentrate on the dissipation data, which I think is really the most informative here, here's what we have. The initial measurements have a very high dissipation peak. The second, the next measurement historically was this partially annealed one, which is down here. In terms of dissipation above the transition, it lies between these. And this is the one which we annealed, which I showed you the warming curve for. And down at the bottom, there are first the measurement taken on the 26th, which I showed before. Below 3/10 of a degree, there's essentially no signal in the period, in the dissipation. It's flat. But what's more significant is this dissipation, essentially, is the dissipation of the empty cell, which tells you that a well-annealed sample, in fact, has no excess dissipation to approximation of what these measurements are made. I'm sure it has some, but it may be a small. It's certainly, if you say there's a, about the scatter of these points is the dissipation here, then this is 100 times bigger. So, and this little decline that you see here is an artifact due to the fact we had a higher amplitude at the time we were at this point. And because the frequency of this oscillator is, below 200 hertz, and the Q is essentially a million, the ring down times are very substantial. And this is seeing that little tail of a ring down, which is, going on. 1 hour is enough to get rid of it, you know.
But your amplitudes are in the same ballpark as Moses.
Yeah. Now, one important point with these oscillators is that the period reacts to changes in the moment of inertia immediately. The amplitude does not react so quickly because if there's a small additional dissipation, then it slowly drops as the energy is taken out. You reduce the dissipation, then you're faced with this ring down associated with this very high Q. So,
when you annealed the last time, did you also see that peak again?
We didn't look at it that time. What we did is we looked at the pressure that was going on. Unfortunately, this, with the configuration we have at the moment, we can't both measure pressure and run the oscillator at the same time. It's not, you know, it's a technical problem which I can solve.
The final annealing, just tell me again what you actually did. Sorry. On 130.06, you did, what was your annealing? I mean, what temperature did you go up to and how long did you wait? And
I can tell you that data, but I don't have a view graph of it. What I want to do is, what I'm asking a graduate student to do is plot up all of the stuff's in the computer, and we can plot temperature versus time for all of 24 hours that the computer was actually acquiring data.
But did you see
during the day, there's a notebook which is filled with numbers which I copied down, so I can tell you what happened then. But most of this annealing business went on between midnight and 8 in the morning or so. And so I don't have those numbers at my fingertips.
John, presumably then if you quench it, it will come back, this strong dissipation peak. Does it? Presumably when you quench it, instead of after you, then the peak come back, right? Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it was there. This is an after annealed. This is a recovered sample, if you like. And the dissipation peak is smaller than it was in, say, this initial one.
But that was after you melted. So you remember.
But the rho S signal, if you like, was equally large. So it's just saying that what's going on in the dissipation may be not completely coupled to what the period signal is.
So the rest of the round is
in. So the
John.
By annealing you properly, you may get rid of stray entities which can slosh around, but they don't actually contribute much to the inertial change. I don't know, but since we don't know what those entities are. We're somewhat of a drift. Okay, this is the linear plot of the data. It's actually a more sensible thing to do is to look at put it on a log scale. You can see better, I think, what's going on. But as I said, these two curves are very close to what we've measured. We've only measured it down at rather low temperatures, but the Q value of the empty cell. So within the error of this, we would say these are essentially zero dissipation configurations of solid helium. And because they've been annealed, it's tempting to say that they're better crystals.
Is all of this with the cylindrical cell?
No, this is the square cell. And Moses has suggested, as well as my wife, that it may be the square cell which makes the difference.
At least on the face of it, there seems to be a contradiction between you and yourself, because the fastest we can cool it, as I said previously, is about 4 hours. And the slowest, the last set we did, is like 40 hours. We don't see the sort of spark very much.
You're at higher pressure, no?
Our data are usually at higher pressure.
Well, this curve.
However, I thought, John, you said in your
this,
high pressure.
This curve is a 42 bar curve. I mean, it was suggested by Moses that maybe that we were, was being close to the melting curve was a crucial thing in this non-observation. But this curve is a curve at where we entered the solid phase at 42 bar rather than 26.
In your cylindrical cell data.
In this case, I believe we were never able to see the super solid signal, because I believe we were not able to traverse the kneeling region quickly enough to preserve whatever disorder is in the system. There's one other thought that occurs to me, possibly, is unique, maybe unique in our experiments, is we're very near the bottom tail of the BCC phase when we go into the solid. It may be that we've nipped the tip of this tail, and because we've got a phase change going from one structure to another, that leaves you with some disorder. But in Moses's case, he's got lots of measurements up here where there's no question about BCC. So, yeah, you probably have somewhere you can right through the middle of this, right? I don't understand.
Moses, do you have data where you go right through the BCC?
I think with the total amount of sample we're studying, we must have.
Which is anneal.
I mean,
go for the BCC,
well,
but anneal.
Using John's definition, our sample are all anneal because we cool down relatively slowly. And also, the last sample, at 46 ppb, again, the phase space getting bigger and bigger. And that is, we did cool down extremely slowly compared with John's.
Moses, in our experience, when you grow a crystal with a block capillary, no matter how slowly you grow it, it's not annealing. If you warm it up, back up to the melting temperature and leave it there for a while, you will anneal out some of the dislocations, but not all.
Some of the dislocations, but not the dislocations.
And also, it's possible, John, to restrain the crystal. If you have an annealed crystal, and you bring it fairly close to the melting curve and put a sudden heat pulse into it, you will introduce a huge number of dislocations into the crystal. And if that's what's doing it, you should get your signal back.
Yeah. Probably so.
John's technique is also block capillary.
Yeah.
It's the same.
Yeah, but he warmed it up. And
we did two.
After you cooled the crystal, you warmed it back up and left it warm for a long time.
Right now we leave it melted for about a couple of hours. So this time we're going to leave it melted for 24 hours.
No, you're not understanding what I'm saying.
I understand.
No, if you grow it from the melt, it will never be strain free.
No, we warm it back up into the liquid solid cooling system.
I know, that's exactly what I'm saying you can't do. Because you're regrowing it from the mixed phase. If you warm it up,
so you have to warm it all the way to liquid.
No, you warm it up so it's all solid and leave the solid warm, and then you anneal out the strains in the solid.
The thing today, what I said is that we sit at 20 millidegrees from the melting point, below the melting point, for 20 hours. Data I showed this morning.
That's different. That's what I'm saying you need to do.
That's what I showed this morning. Okay.
Well, but. This drawing here, I think, sort of illustrates John's point that you want to take your sample and warm it up to near the melting curve, say here, and just stay there for a while. The fact that the dissipation is so low here indicates that probably you've already annealed it.
Not sure.
Well, why would we go from this state of dissipation to this one? Do a slow cool from here. We don't go back up here. We go in with these low Q samples. So
in your cylindrical cell, you have some data for the cylindrical.
Yeah, I don't have any data which would cast any light on this question.
So you did not do this fast?
No. That cell had all kinds of problems. I believe it was failing, actually, even when we did our successful measurements, because there were a lot of noise spikes, and I think what was happening is there's a crack propagating down the outside of the, underneath the magnesium shell, and gradually bulging it out, and when we jacked up the pressure, it just got separated, crack propagated all the way through. And with these oscillators, any kind of mechanical disturbance in the structure itself. And Shirahama can testify to that, with his low Q in the empty oscillator. So it takes very, very little something or other to destroy the quality. Yes, John?
Do you have any idea how much helium-3 is in your sample?
Whatever comes in the gas bottle we bought. And so it's well, helium is not so it's probably this so quotes canonical 0.3 ppm. We haven't studied the effects of helium.
Your cell x y directions by the same.
The geometry of the cell is basically square with rounded corners, and the height is slightly larger than the square cross section dimension. So it's not a quite a cube, but a slightly elongated cube. But well, let me say what are our conclusions from this. Well, first. With just the confirmation of the Kim Chan results, which was pointed out by Science Magazine as being one of the things to do in the year 2006, and now we've done it in 2005. And the second is that there exist two forms of solid helium with respect to what you see in these torsional oscillator experiments. An annealed crystal does not show a supersolid signal. That's one state. It's characterized by low dissipation. And a disordered form characterized by high dissipation, which does show the supersolid phenomena. And, well, the last point was just the distinction between these two. You can tell ahead of time when you're cooling down which state you're going to go into by what the dissipation is. And you can, by annealing, you can remove whatever those defects are which are leading to this dissipation. They leave the system and the dissipation essentially goes to zero. And then you don't see any supersolid. Now these ideas fit rather cozily with some of the current theoretical suggestions, namely that in an ideal HCP crystal there is no supersolid. And secondly, if you have a glassy structure, there would be a supersolid. Now, not to say this is a glass, but it certainly has something in it. And why it is and what the growth mechanisms are which cause Moses' samples to always have disorder, and presumably the question is, when you apply the dissipation criterion, how close are you to the empty cell? You're always way above it, I believe. I think that's true. That the dissipation above the transition is large compared to the what you have when there's no solid in the cell. Okay, so.
So John, in your case, if you see a super solid signal comes back, so at the lowest temperature, you still will have dissipation, is that right?
We have, but it's dropped down. Not all the way to the empty cell, but I'll show you one of these curves. Like once they begin to lie on top of each other. Okay. The best data is this orange or pink one, or I don't know what color it is, where we've got the supersolid signal, and this is dissipation curves, and it goes down here. You see it's up at a value of about 3 as opposed to 1. But up here, we're at 8. So we've dropped by more than the factor of 2 in dissipation, going from above the transition to below. There we are.
On the face of it, I think there is a kind of, sort of, I don't quite understand. Hmm? On the face of it, there is a contrary result because we have sit at the,
there's something is going on in your cell.
Maybe there's some other variable.
Yeah, maybe there's something.
What about the walls of the container in terms of seeding the crystal? I mean, how are they different materials?
Well, the sort of thing we're saying that may depend on geometry, which is a very, very, very speculative. One possibility is the following, that let's assume affecting the cylindrical cell, that by the time you anneal it or something like that, that the C-axis will always be parallel to the axis of rotation. Let's say, and this is completely speculative, and let's say that this is very conducive for you to develop superflow. I'm saying that the superflow is possibly anisotropic. This is maybe crazy, right? But then in the square cell, what happened that is it possible with the fact that when you cool down very quickly, you may induce orientation. There's some HCP, the HCP axis is not completely parallel to the rotational axis, but some of it is. But if you really anneal it carefully, the HCP axis can be perpendicular to the axis of rotation. That is your preferred orientation to growth. Like whether the material is sitting the helium or just the I just don't know.
Yeah,
I'm just completely puzzled.
Yeah, but the important feature is the two different states, one of which produces a supersolid signal and one of which does not. And one, it's not a question of the details of how you grow an disordered system.
What we're saying is that somehow, whatever is, if that is the case, then the logical conclusion is somehow at Penn State, 175 miles down south, we always lock into one state, and you are able to accept both states. That's the thing.
Yeah, but the fact is there are two states exist. That wasn't known before now.
So can you redo your
effect? It's a continuum of states. He gets a smaller effect when he anneals.
Yeah.
So why do you say it's two? It's a continuum.
Is it like two different phases?
But the temperature of the kink, or whatever it is, stays around the same, which is a bit surprising.
I mean, you might have... The effect gets smaller when you know.
The superfluid density is going down. Yeah. You know, why wouldn't the temperature where the effect slips in?
So can you redo your experiment?
The defects are the same, but the concentration is changing.
Yeah,
but you don't depend on the density of defects to produce the mass signal.
I think one of the basic significant things that John pointed out is that he's really a new signal. The dissipation goes back to the empty cell. That means that the pair things are really, they're locked together, and it's a very, they have no dissipation.
So if you redid your experiment in bicore on some kind of porous...
Yeah, well, one shouldn't forget about bicore, because that's kind of somewhat arguing against the idea it's a special crystal direction.
I think that calibration is interesting.
The wonderful time for experimentalists, because there's so much to do, so many variables to change and so forth. Yes.
How are the peripheral velocities in your set compared with those?
We stay down fairly low, but we don't go down to 1 micron a second. These typically are 10 to 20 microns a second. And we don't seem to see, and that rate is not a very sensitive range for this sort of thing. And so we're learning to do the experiment. And on a lot of these runs, the reason there are glitches and so forth in the data is we've changed the drive level or something because we thought the amplitude was going to get too low or something of that sort. Now that we have more experience, we can set it to begin with and leave it, and then get a cleaner set of data. It doesn't contain any more physics, but it looks prettier.
Well, it's still sort of strange, right? Because you say that your cooling rate is 1 hour, you have one particular state. And somehow, where's the time scale come from? Why is it 10 hours? Certainly it's not the time scale of the atomic time scale of hydrogen or helium.
We don't have a directly on the cell, but we don't. And it's only when we're on the melting curve that we can determine the temperature from the pressure.
John has a lot more experience, but as I read a lot of the old paper from Graywall and other people,
they would say that the annealing, you know, when the framework did the ultrasound, and then he said that the annealing process, you know, continued to change over, 24, 30 hours. That
it depends on the density. And our experience is that there are some random variables that we couldn't control very well. We didn't always get perfect crystals from our user's standard technique. And so we threw out a lot, but there was so much dislocation damping, we couldn't see the phenomena we were interested in. And I would be a little bit worried that some of the effect you're talking about that you're attributing to a parameter that's controllable is not. And you're getting random amounts of lattice defects in the system, and you've got a very pure, good quality single crystal, and you've got no dissipation.
Yeah, that's the
Yeah, you would take the low dissipation as quality, crystal quality.
If it's analogous indicator. To what we see with acoustics, certainly.
Yeah. Okay.
Do you normally grow your crystals with no excitation on the oscillator?
We've done it both ways.
Doesn't make a difference.
We haven't done enough to say, but.
Do you, Moses? Do you do both ways?
We usually keep it oscillating.
What do you do? Well, that could establish a preferred axis.
But isn't a normal ambient vibration?
No, it shouldn't.
No, that should be lower.
The reason I'm saying that is that because we always try to measure when, you know, freezing begin, when melting. That's so we thought there's an extra parameter we can monitor.
Yeah, but your pressure gauge. I mean, you can run both. Of course.
Well, yeah, so we monitor all three things. That's what we usually do. So, and I don't think we have intentionally do not oscillate to grow the crystal. We have not.
Do you know, John, the one that was such a good crystal?
Typically, we've been running, when we're cooling to freeze, we usually have the pressure gauge running, rather than the oscillator. Although,
same thing on the one where you saw no dissipation, you were not oscillating when you cooled down, when you
formed
the crystal.
That's crazy.
Well, we've always switched the oscillator on as soon as we were fairly sure we're in this completely solid phase, which that would be told us to us by the.
Somebody walks across the room.
Well, also, when it is in liquid, and as John, we certainly see the same thing. When it's liquid-solid coexistence, the Q is terrible. And in order to see that, you tend to oscillate it hard in order to see it. So that is certainly true. I mean, we cannot so drive it like, this 7 angstrom to see anything in the coexistence region. You don't see anything at all. The oscillator will not oscillate, will die. That's the phrase we say. I mean, there's some parameter we're not doing the same. I mean, that's all I can say. And I guess I'm.
Oh, a different cell.
You blame it on the geometry. I don't know. That seems to be a.
What I wonder, you have a larger hold on your torsion rod than we do.
Yes.
And that may be.
You have a larger hole in the.
Yeah, the line. We use a number 80 drill, and they use a number 70, or what? Anyway, so with the larger hole, you are, through the last plastic flow of helium, connected to the external world of the mixing chamber more strongly, and maybe toothpaste effects take place or something, which you flow,
again,
which strain your crystal while you're...
You also cool from the torsion rod, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you are also cooled from the torsion rod, therefore it nucleated in a very small ID.
No, because the torsion rod enters, that's not the geometry. We're not cooling with the liquid in the torsion rod, which by this time is, the conductivity is going way down.
No, the first formation of solid will be at the coldest point.
Yeah, but... I mean, the cell, the bottom of the cell is something like this. Torsion rod goes down here, and the little tube comes up like this. And this is all the same piece of metal.
Yeah.
So the cooling here gets, no doubt, gets distributed in this. I mean, one can there isn't a single point here necessarily. It's certainly probably true. It forms in the bottom of the cell.
The solid you created from the torsion bar.
Why? Why couldn't it nucleate over here? Because there's some little nucleation center. Because the temperature profiles, I mean, heat is flowing into this surface here and being eventually extracted down the trough.
But where's the mixing chamber? The mixing chamber is...
Not about where the floor is.
Right. So what John is showing is...
Heat flows down the trough.
This is helium, right? Okay, so in here and here, this is attached to the mixing chamber, right?
It's attached to the isolator, actually.
This is the focus point.
Yes.
Therefore, solid will nucleate from here before it gets to the cell.
Sure. They're even further down.
Yes.
The mixing chamber itself, where these fill lines are heat sunk, is colder still.
I understand that.
What was the problem? Suppose
no, I thought you were indicating that there was a physical point in the cell.
No.
What you said.
What would be the problem with the solid decay from there?
Therefore, if first little solid. Solid helium you grow will have physical dimension on the order of this size.
Yeah.
Okay. Therefore, that is a C. Yeah. Okay. So where did this little bad? I don't know. John, this one is much smaller. Ours is a factor of 2 or 3 larger. Okay. So here, the issue is that we want the solid here to be good crystal.
Right.
But it started with something very small. So to me, that is not easy. And that is the reason that, you know, an experiment, when we cool from here, the coldest from here, we seem to have less scatter. But it was possible that, in fact, this is very small, that maybe he hit on something, I don't know.
He only was able to produce his samples with less dissipation, right? So perfect crystal growing out of this very narrow channel.
Right.
Well, what we've hit on, Moses, is that we apparently in this cell you don't have to melt it. You can just take it up to high temperature and let it sit, and then the Q goes up.
So what you're saying is that with the torsion rod, with the torsion rod ID smaller, then the crystal in the torsional cell is actually decoupled with what's going on in the capillary and so on and so forth. Possibly.
Yeah. Well, but that's... You're saying with the bigger one, somehow or other you freeze disorder into the system when the crystal starts to grow, always. And that's main. But why doesn't it go away when you anneal?
Well, I don't know.
I'm also saying that he doesn't see it go away. When he anneals, he doesn't anneal the way you anneal out all of them. You see how the dissipation. Yeah.
Well, I don't know what happens to your dissipation during your annealing process.
Well, as I said, I would have Anselm to send me the data, but
So, if these defects are responsible for the dissipation, why should the energy has anything to do with the TC of the period? Your peak is occurring somewhere below TC, but roughly of the order. So that energy scale shouldn't have anything to do with the defect energy scale. So because what we're saying is that there's some defects, and those defects can cause something to happen. So
yeah,
that
there may be more than one class of defects, some of which contribute to superfluidity and some do not. But they may... I don't know. I mean, we don't know what.
No, but I'm saying experimentally they're related. That's
no, they're it. Not. This location is a very high energy thing. It can make a huge difference in the properties, thermodynamic as well as dynamical ones.
Okay, so then that dissipation peak is not related to the growth process defects then.
No,
it's related to the consequences of having those defects.
Oh, yes.
This
yes,
interpretation.
I agree with you. For example, there are very low energy excitations on dislocation lines themselves. There are kinks. And they have an activation energy of something around 1/4 degree of Kelvin. So they can completely change the behavior of the system just because you've got the dislocations there. So I think that's what you're saying. Okay.
And, well, of course, it's very interesting that there's this large dissipation peak in the warming curve. And there is a change in the period, too, associated, somewhat reminiscent of the supersolid period shift. So, associated with this, I can show you the data. I've got it in my office, but I can make a slide for later. But associated with this peak in the warming curve, there is a change in the period of the oscillator, and it increases as you go above this peak.
Yeah, but this one I was asking.
Then there's some other features which.
There has to be a connection between the two at some level.
Yeah.
Is it the Parmer's
problem?
Yeah. It shows a small change, but it's not.
The fact that numbers don't work out right for the.
But part of it could still be from that. So.
Oh yeah, but it may be the frequency pulling effects of the Q changes are way below the frequency changes actually observed.
Should we move on to the next?
Yes. Please.
We have time for more discussion, but go ahead while he's setting up.
We've got a week. Right.